Action Alerts Plus subscribers, AAP podcast listeners, Chris Versace back here, bringing our latest thoughts about what's going on in the markets, the economy, and so much more. And folks, you are in for a treat. That's right, Carly Gardner is joining me today to talk all about that and much more, bringing her expertise to bear about futures, options, and so much more. So with that, let's just get right to it. Carly Gardner, how the hell are you?
Hey, Chris, it's good to be here. I'm good, no complaints. The week's young, though, and it's going to be a busy week.
It is a busy week. I mean, as we're talking this, let's just set the stage. NASDAQ last week put in some nice highs, traded off on Monday, looks a little weaker today. February services PMI came out. Sounds like the service economy is still strong, but prices, all those indicators are moving higher. That sets the stage for our good friend, JP, when he does his semi-annual testimony tomorrow in front of Congress. And I do expect Powell will, I don't know if he'll double down, as some folks are saying, Carly, on pushing back on rate hike timing, but I think he's going to reiterate the slow path for those cuts. I'll be listening for his body language and his overall language about hints as to timing. I increasingly think those are going to slip into the second half of the year. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, in a sense, Powell is a bit of a traitor, right? It's not in the conventional sense, but that's exactly what he's doing. And sometimes less is more. I feel like this is a time for him and most people, to be honest, in their investment accounts and trading accounts, to maybe take a step back. Let's wait, see how the cards fall, and go from there. It's trying to force moves or do things just because you feel like you need to do something is never a good idea for us, and definitely not for Jerome Powell.
Totally agree. When it comes to the market and this kind of, you know, I can't call it a sell-off because we're kind of trending lower Monday and so far today. Maybe tomorrow after Powell speaks, we'll see. But I see that as kind of a healthy period of some call it digestion, rationalization, call it what you will, because we've been on a very strong upward move. And I think if we can kind of, not that I'm the technician that Helene Meisler is or Bob Lang is or some other folks are, like yourself, I wouldn't say base here, but I think if we can kind of catch our breath, let some of the froth come out of the market, I think that would be positive for everybody.
100%. What we're seeing, in my opinion, especially in tech stocks, NASDAQ 100, I follow pretty closely because there's a futures contract associated with it. It's unhealthy. It's not healthy to see markets move in with this amount of volatility. Everybody's, for whatever reason, we've gotten into this habit of everybody getting to all on one side of the bus and then moving to the other side and vice versa. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, October of last year, 2023, everybody was bearish. Nobody was looking for a rally. Everyone assumed that we were getting a recession and interest rates were higher for longer and all of these things. And, you know, things flipped pretty quickly. Just as we saw then, I think we could see something like that. Now, I'm not saying we're going into some massive recession. Everybody should sell all their assets and put money under their mattress. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying a very nice, healthy correction would be welcomed.
And a healthy correction, in your view, is 5%, a little more?
Well, probably a little more than that. I follow the S&P primarily. I mean, tech stocks obviously are kind of taking the show at this particular moment, but generally the S&P is a much smoother index. Normally it is actually following NVIDIA and the tech stocks, just like everything else is. With that said, according to our weekly and monthly charts in the S&P, if we do get into correction mode, it wouldn't be that out of line to see somewhere in the mid 4,000s, maybe even the 4,300 area. Even that big of a, that sounds like a lot, I know, but in reality, that keeps the uptrend intact. Honestly, that would probably be ideal. And it would give anyone that's missed the boat here, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that have, it would give them a nice chance to put something to work there.
Totally agree. So the message that I shared with AAP members in our daily rundown video today was that, look, if we see the market pull back, we have cash. We have our inverse ETFs that are currently working for us the last couple of days, and we have our shopping list. We know what positions we want to go after at lower prices. We know the catalysts we're looking for. You know, for example, just to share one, maybe you'd want to weigh in or not, I don't know. you know, there's a lot of talk about how either Google or Apple are kind of really missing the AI wave. But, you know, when I sit there, Carly, and I think about Google, and I think about all the information that they have, right, through Gmail, through Google Calendar, through search, through YouTube, and all the other various apps that they have, not only that we as individuals use, but corporate customers, schools are using. They have a treasure trove of data. And I have to think that at some point they are gonna get this right when it comes to AI. Flipping to Apple, look, they're not in the lead anywhere close to what others are doing on AI because they focus on privacy so much. There's some concern about their smartphone volumes in the first half of the year. Totally understandable given some data today. But it's the AI device upgrade cycle that we heard. That was the message at CES 2024, Mobile World Congress. Dell talked about it. It's going to unfold in the back half of the year. It's that upgrade cycle we want to capture for Apple. And I just call these out because, as you were mentioning, both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, they're pretty big components. So they're weighing on the market right now.
They are 100%. I'll leave the fundamentals to you. You've got that covered pretty nicely. Chart-wise, that's where I get a little bit concerned. If you draw a trend line in the NASDAQ 100 futures, and I'm a futures broker, that's why I follow the futures, but also futures trade 24 hours. So the charts are actually a little more telling than maybe if you looked at like Qs, because we're trading futures 24 hours a day, and so they're just a little smoother. There's not as many price gaps. With that said, if you draw a trend line from the highs of 2000, so the dot-com bubble, through the 2021 highs through today, it comes in at about 18,000 for the NASDAQ 100. And we've kind of been trading on both sides of that. If we settle below 18,000 this week, I'd say that's pretty bearish. That tells me that we're probably getting into a situation where the froth is probably going to be taken out. People are going to look to take profits, and we probably get some selling coming. The one thing that's catching my eye is the RSI, which is the relative strength index. If you look at the RSI on a weekly, daily, or even a monthly chart, not only is it overbought, but it's showing divergence. And what that means is, as the futures market is making new highs, the RSI is not. And that's just kind of a sign of dysfunction and waning momentum. So if you look at the chart, it looks like there's tons of momentum. But if you look at the RSI, it's telling us that maybe something's wrong. And again, leaning towards a little bit of a correction here.
Well, we appreciate those comments on the RSI. We follow those very closely when we're looking kind of at the market, particularly that 70 level of late, which classic, I think, Jay Woods over at Freedom Capital, frequent guest here, is like classic overbought sign. Yeah. So that is something that we are kind of watching. Okay. Any other thoughts on the market, Carly, in general, before we move on to a couple more specifics that are really in your wheelhouse?
This is a little off topic, but I'm starting to see signs of very overheated sentiment as well. The CNN's Fear and Greed Index has been touching, bouncing between greed and extreme greed for a handful of months now. But the most interesting thing to me was Noriel Robini suddenly came out yesterday and said he's no longer bearish. And if anyone's been following him, I'm not criticizing any analysts because I've made some really bad calls over the years, but unless I miss something, I think he's been bearish since the financial crisis. So the fact that he's not bearish now is very interesting to me, and maybe a clue.
I believe you tweeted something to that effect, correct?
I did.
I did. I saw it. I believe I liked it, hearted it, whatever that is on that platform now known as X. And that's actually a great question. Carly, for folks who want to follow you on Twitter, what's the handle?
At Carly Garner. So Carley Garner.
Pretty simple. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's move into some commodities. Gold. Gold has been strong of late. I know Bob Lang is a big fan of it, but what do you think about the shiny metal?
Gold is a very, very tricky market. It will trade sideways for years, sometimes decades, and then it makes its move all in a month or two. And I think that's maybe exactly what we're seeing. Gold's been trading sideways for 4 years. It's been trying to break above 2100. This is the fifth time it's attempted, and we actually did it yesterday. I'm not saying we don't get some back and filling and some switchback trading. It's going to be volatile, but I actually think this is what we've been waiting for. You know, gold didn't go up when everyone was talking about inflation, geopolitical risks, all of those things that normally would say, hey, we should buy gold. Gold didn't do anything. But now that everybody's watching Bitcoin and Nvidia, nobody's watching gold. Guess what? It's making its move. And I think this might be the move. If it is, I'm thinking like 2,500 to 2,600 could be seen.
In what time frame do you think that is? Is it as short as a month, or is it more pronounced 6 months, something like that?
It's tough. I mean, I remember like 2007, 2008, it moves like that type of a breakout rally was 6 months. So, I mean, if it's going to happen, it's probably going to happen probably by the end of the year. Let's just say that.
Okay. And conversely, you know, you said we might backfill in around the 2100 level. If it sells off to a certain level, is there a warning sign that you would be looking for?
I would say as long as, I mean, I'd be hoping that it holds about 2050. That'd be pretty reasonable on a pullback. But as long as it stays above 2000, I'm going to put a floor at 2000. As long as it stays above that, I think the path of least resistance is higher. Gold is one of those markets, though, if it breaks support, it just melts down, and it's a tough position to be in. But I don't think that's going to happen. I'm leaning higher here.
By the way, I see what you did there. Little gold fun. Melts. Yep. Melts. I get it. Very good. Very good. Okay, let's move over to the ag commodities. And, you know, last year when we had the shares of Deer and Company in the AEP portfolio, I was always very interested in what you were saying with corn, wheat, and soybeans, just given what they meant for farmer income. We no longer have Deer in the portfolio, so I'm not as interested. But from a pure inflation perspective, or just other input cost perspective, what are you seeing in these three key ag commodities that are corn, wheat, and soybeans?
Corn, wheat, and soybeans were kind of victims of their own success. There was just too much speculative money, too much overhyping in the last couple of years as they were in their bull phases. And now we're getting the imminent. It happens all the time in commodities, the boom and the bust. We're in the bust cycle. I think in the short run, particularly for the grains, like we're going into planting season and then we've got growing season. There's a lot that can go wrong and we're on kind of our back feet. So my guess is we probably get some sort of a spring or summer rally as we digest how the weather is and what goes on. But the reality is farmers in this country are really, really good at what they do. Brazil is starting to become a really big player in the space. And so there's a supply issue. So even though I think short run, we get a little spike in grains, and that might put a little pressure on inflation. I think in the long run, it probably rolls back over and we end up next year probably even lower than we are this year. I hope I'm wrong because I have a lot of farmer friends, but I think that's probably what's going to happen.
Oh, you got to call it like you see it, Carly. And I think that's one of the issues where, from our perspective, just on Deer, we were concerned about, you know, a couple different things, demand for equipment and lower prices for these ag commodities. Yeah. Slowing the replacement cycle, or in some cases, the upgrade cycle to precision ag. So maybe we will revisit Deer at some point, but not in the near term, that's for sure. Okay, coffee. Now, I like to follow the coffee market, and I know we have a good mutual friend who specializes in the coffee market. And her comments, I think, I want to say two and a half years ago were spot on. In terms of the destruction of coffee plants and what the longer term impact was going to be on supply. And lo and behold, Carly, I was at local grocery store Harris Teeter, and I was like, oh, I got to get a pound of coffee, which is not a pound of coffee. It's only 12 ounces, but that's neither here nor there. $16.
Wow.
I almost fell out of the chair. You know, I was like, that's ridiculous. But, yeah. But you know, when it comes
it's
to company. I couldn't do what I do without that drink every morning. So I totally agree with you on that. That's probably, if I had two or three vices, that's probably one or two. So not necessarily the worst thing in the world. But let me ask you though, so because we think about coffee and this next one, cocoa, kind of about input costs. When we take a look at companies, lesser extent like Starbucks, but cocoa for sure with like, you know, the Hershey company, and that stock has been battered. I just read an article that chocolate manufacturers are now flirting with new formulations to reduce the amount of chocolate because it has gotten so pricey. So tell us what you're seeing in these arguably guilty pleasure commodities.
Right. Well, the thing that's interesting about these two particular commodities is they are, first of all, they're not grown in the U.S. They are grown in they're grown in less developed areas of the world. And so when we're looking at fundamental data, it's almost impossible to get numbers. When we do get numbers, we really don't trust them. It's not like in the U.S. we have USDA that goes through and puts pretty extensive data together. And not everybody trusts the USDA, but we can like reasonably say they're probably giving it their best shot. Right. In some of these other parts of the world, that's not the case. In fact, they might even be manipulating data to manipulate prices. So it's really, really tricky. With that said, I've been doing this long enough to know that when you get a really big euphoric boom in commodity, any commodity, whether it's natural gas, like we saw a few years ago, lumber a few years ago, now we're getting that in cocoa, the bust will come. And I would not be shocked to see cocoa trading under 2000 by the end of the year. So right now we're trading, it's extremely volatile, but we're between like $5,000 and $6,000.
Whoa.
So we started in the twos and threes and we ended up around 6,000. So it sounds like impossible for us to get back to two, but it's not, trust me. When natural gas was trading at $10 a year and a half ago, nobody was calling for $1.60 yet. That's what we saw last week. Anything could happen.
What do you look for, whether in the charts or other data, that kind of says, okay, yes, this thesis that I laid out for it to move lower is starting to play out?
Well, I mean, cocoa has been a really tricky one because not only is it the fundamentals hard to get information on, it's a thinner market. Not everybody has access. Not everyone has access to data because it trades on the ICE exchange, and the ICE exchange is not very friendly when it comes to giving people data. They charge really high fees and it's just outrageous. So a lot of people are flying blind. A lot of people are flying on low capital because the exchange had the margins way too low. So I think what we're seeing with the $6,000 prices in cocoa, I think is not only temporary, but probably artificially inflated. And so I think that's when and where it ends. I don't know. I wish I did. I'd be rich if I could pick the exact top on something like that. But all I know is things will get better. And so those people that rely on those, for input costs and things like that, it will get better. It will relax. This is not permanent.
So if I read between the lines, as that happens, these price increases that we're seeing that, candy companies are still putting in today, at some point, like we saw with Deer last year and other companies, that actually becomes a margin driver, sounds like.
It does, because what happens is, I mean, prices jump like this and then consumers change their behavior, producers change their behavior, and eventually it works itself out. That's just how it works. In a market that isn't renewable, that might not be the case, but most commodities are renewable. Cocoa maybe not renewable immediately, but give it a couple of years and we'll probably be oversupplied. It wasn't that long ago in coffee that we were trading in the 70s, 80 cent area. There were stories of farmers in South America committing suicide because they just couldn't feed their families. And then sure enough, prices recovered because supply went down, demand goes up. It's just how commodities work.
Okay. And are you seeing any relief in the coffee market? I'm asking for a friend, meaning me.
To be honest, I don't have a really strong opinion in coffee here. I'd probably be bullish if we had a nice pullback, but we're a little too high to buy and not cheap enough to, or I'm sorry, a little too high to, yeah, not high enough to sell, a little too high to buy. I wouldn't touch it either way. My best guess is though, we're probably not going to see any really big retreats in coffee soon. We'll stay steady to higher in the long run.
Okay. All right. And then you mentioned natural gas. So I've got to ask. Thoughts on oil, especially after the announced extension by OPEC Plus through the end of the second quarter?
Oil's up against some pretty good resistance around the $80 area. We're backing off a little from that. That back off might continue in the short run, but I do think at some point, probably within the next handful of weeks, we make our way above 80. And once we get above 80, it breaks a downtrend line. And that's where we start to probably see some upside prices. I think we've got a chance at seeing the mid-90s to maybe even $100 at some point later in the year. I don't think it's going to be anything dramatic like we've seen in the last handful of years where oil jumps $20 in a week. I think those days are over. I think it'll be more of a slow grind, which is a lot easier for consumers and producers to manage anyway.
And just in your thinking on that, even though I am the fundamental guy, China came out today and they set a 5% GDP target. I think the Bloomberg survey for 2024 GDP was like 4.5, 4.6%. So people are calling for more stimulus. If that happens, that kind of supports your thought process that that economy gets back on track, global demand rises for oil. They are the largest importer of oil. That would help a kind of drive towards that price target you're talking.
Right, exactly. Oil has been managed to hold the $70 area and rally up to 80 without China even helping us out. And so if any of that Chinese demand comes back online, that's a pretty nice boost. As far as natural gas goes, natural gas hasn't really spent much time at all under $2. So we're currently front month's a little under $2 now. We were much lower last week. I think we're in the process of bottoming. Bottoms are a process, not an event. So I can't rule out one more dip, maybe it's some sort of double bottom. But the reality is we're probably not going to stay under $2 for forever. I don't think we're going to see $8, $10 like we saw a few years ago. I think we're going back into a trading range like we saw between like 2010 and 2020, where we basically were between roughly $2 and $4. So we might see something more like that for the next handful of years.
Yeah, but if you pick it up at the right price below two, right, that's a double. Possibly.
Actually, I prefer it. I prefer it. It got a little too wild the last couple of years. I mean, that was a really tough trade. It looks easy when you look at a chart and you say, wow, gas went from $2 to $10. Look how much money someone made. But they never go straight there. It's always a you know, wiggly road, and it's hard to stay in. So it's a tough trade.
You know, it's a good point because it's, you know, hindsight, things right, always look easy, right? They always look easy. And whether it's, you know, commodities or individual stocks, you know, at the time, you're always weighing a lot of things. You're weighing what could go right, what could go wrong, fundamental factors, technical factors, and you've got to make the best decision that you can at the time. And I think, you know, it's a lot like making pizza, Carly. And what I mean by that is, If I were to give two people the same set of ingredients, someone would make something that is utterly delicious, fantastic. I'd want to have it time and time again. Somebody else, too much sauce, too little cheese, too much cheese, who knows, right? So it's that experience that really helps craft our insight, our thinking. And we've both been doing this a long time. So when you say that you see something, I believe it. So with that, Carly, we're going to shift a little bit. We're going to have a little bit of fun. The business is out of the way, so the fun part of this conversation. For those folks who may not know this about you, you reside in or work out of Las Vegas, correct?
I do. That is correct.
And there's a lot going on there lately with sports teams, Super Bowl, the Sphere, the Indy 500 was there. There's just so much going on, and it tends to congregate in and around the Strip. So my question for you is, for the person who goes there and has either been there tons of time and doesn't want to go to the Strip, they want to see the real Las Vegas, as it were, or they're the type of person that doesn't like all the bells, whistles, slot machines, and all that other stuff, in your opinion, with you as our love boat, Julie McCoy, steward, sorry. I thought, that I had that all lined up in my head. It just didn't translate very well. What are some of the places, what are some of your big recommendations for people who are going to Vegas?
Okay, so I've been in Vegas since 1999. I came here to go to college and I stuck around because I love it so much. When I got here, the population was like 780,000 and now we're almost 3 million. So I've been here, I've seen it, I know where to go. If you want to see Vegas, get off the Strip. Number one is Fremont Street. It's still casino area, but it's the older part of town, has light canopies, zip lines. It's completely amazing and the best people watching on the planet, hands down.
Did you say zip lines?
Zip lines, yeah. It's the most amazing six block area on the planet. And I'm a traveler. I've seen some things. On okay, so number two is going to be Mount Charleston. Nobody knows this, but I live kind of on the edge of town. But I can, from my house, it's in still in town. It's very populous here. From my house to hiking trails on the mountain is only 25-minute drive, and it's absolutely stunning. It doesn't look like much from the city. It looks like some hills without trees, but if you get in there, it's absolutely beautiful. And I grew up in Utah around very beautiful mountains, so I know these mountains are up there.
And you've posted mm-hmm. some pictures on social media of these mountains.
Yeah, I have. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
They're amazing. Okay. Number three is probably I'm going to say Red Rock Canyon. Red Rock Canyon is more of a desert area. It's right out of town. You can be from the Strip to Red Rock is probably a 10-15 minute drive, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Hiking trails, there's burros, there's mountain lions, all kinds of crazy stuff out there. It's fun. You don't want to see a mountain lion, but you should be prepared. I have when I go hiking out there, I have a blowhorn on my backpacks just in case.
I have a house in the mountains of Virginia where there are black bears. Ooh. And you don't go outside unless you've got your bear spray, your bear horn, and your bear bell.
That's a good idea.
And if someone in the area forgets to close the dumpster, it's a big problem because the bears will go in and tear through everything. So, but one last question as it relates to Vegas. So three great places to check out. Best place to eat.
My favorite restaurant in Vegas is a little place called Esther's Kitchen. It's downtown. It's mostly locals. Tourists don't really know about it. Maybe they will now. Little Italian place, locally owned, mom and pop shop.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, I was there to see you two at the Sphere, a quick in and out trip, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. I understand that Fish is coming. I believe the Dead and Company is coming. So you might see the Street's own J.D. Durkin out there, possibly.
Oh, cool.
Maybe. We'll see. And some other bands. Have you been to the Sphere at all or no?
I haven't been for a concert, but I went for the movie and it was pretty amazing. As far as a concert, I'm waiting for like maybe something a little newer, like maybe a 90s band. So we'll see.
anybody on the wish list for that?
No, I honestly haven't thought about that much. I'm a big Post Malone fan, but he's probably a little too current for the Sphere, I feel like.
So here's my theory on what works at the Sphere. It's a very elaborate production, right? It's not mm-hmm. a concert, it's a show.
Yeah.
Right. So like person I've seen about 50 times, Bruce Springsteen, right? Mm-hmm. Love to see him in person, wonderful concert. I do not think that what he excels at would not go over well in the Sphere because it's not that big production. There's a lot of set up time, graphics, and everything else that goes into it. And when it works, like it did with you two, it's phenomenal. But I'm hoping you get your chance. I would strongly urge that you go see a concert that you like at the Sphere. I do think it is going to be the future of live entertainment.
Yeah, I think it's cool. Can't wait.
Excellent, excellent. Carly, anything else we got to talk about before we get out of here?
No, I think we did a pretty good job of covering the bases.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I always value your input. I hope that we can do this again before too long. And until then, members, that's our podcast for today. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.